Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, back now on The Takeaway. If you have a string of pearls, this is going to be a good time to clutch them. Because we're talking about corporate advertising on social media. And in case you haven't noticed, many big brands have gone from racy innuendo to full-fledged raunchy sales pitches. That sex sells is a truism in advertising. But even for those of us who no one would describe as prudish, recent social media for many beloved brands has gone from suggestive to downright smutty. Take a glance at some beloved brands, and you'll find Oreo comparing itself to the Big O, and KFC's Spanish language account posting fan art of a scantily clad Colonel Sanders. It seems that companies have embraced the digitally raunchy. But how effective are these naughty incursions into our social media feeds? And does dancing along the edge of the pornographic translate into more purchases? Nathan Alibach is creative director at Alibach Communications and a freelance writer covering internet culture. His recent piece on brands for Vulture is what got us talking about this. Nathan, welcome to The Takeaway.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Melissa.
All right, so what's going on here? Is this just the latest iteration of sex sells, or is this something new?
Yeah, so that's kind of where everybody's mind goes when they hear about brands acting aroused online. And I've been trying to differentiate what's traditionally known as sex sells from this, which I'm calling horny shocks, which is essentially a different strategy altogether. Whereas, you know, in the past, sex sells would be using models and kind of sexual imagery and, you know, lips and things like that to really get through a message. This strategy, if you want to call it that, from brands is much more about just shocking and provoking the audience to get them to kind of drop their jaw and be like, yeah, why is this brand themselves acting aroused, essentially?
All right. So this is interesting to me. And I'm wondering, you know, typically, presumably, brands, corporations respond to whatever the incentive structure is around them, right? So we get the kind of sex sells version of in the 90s and the 80s, because it has a real incentive structure. It does, in fact, sell. So horny shocks, is this because shock has its own particular purchase value on social media? In other words, Twitter creates new incentives that, for example, TV and radio don't have.
Absolutely. Yeah. Like when you look at the past few years, figures like Trump or Elon Musk, you know, they've been able to kind of generate this gravitational pull where they post something that's intentionally polarizing or inflammatory, and it just draws in this kind of zeitgeist of engagement where you've got people that are mad about the thing that was posted, and then you have people defending the thing that was posted, and it's like this ping pong effect that goes back and forth. And similarly, brands have tapped into this sort of way of provocation, and now they're just trying to figure out, you know, what is going to get us the most engagement in this ever-growing attention economy that we live in, where everybody's just so saturated with media consumption that it's more and more difficult for them to stand out with their marketing.
Nathan, I love so much that you went immediately to the politics example here, in part because I'm often sort of, you know, as a political science professor, when I'm talking to students, it's interesting to me how many business students I end up with in my classes, because that notion of selling a candidate and selling a brand are so similar. And I hadn't thought of it until you said it now, but this is almost like the Trumpification in the sense of a 2016 Trump campaign strategy, right? The Trumpification of these brands, because it is like just shocking things that people then retweet or share to say, can you believe you saw this thing?
Yeah, in the advertising industry, we've been kind of colloquially referring this to as people now want to be brands and brands now want to be people, where there's this kind of constant ebb and flow where people, individuals, want to brand build to be influencers and these kind of public figures online. And then brands are having a difficult time standing out within that ecosystem. So they try to act human to kind of break through and relate to people and you know, play as if they're the person behind the account, essentially. And a large part of that is just this kind of, it's not all cheap shock value stuff, but in this new environment where we have just so many get viral quick moments, it's just really difficult, I think, for a lot of brands to break through the noise. So these types of strategies become much more common.
All right. So set this strategy next to something else that's gone on in recent years. So since the second wave of the Black Lives Matter uprisings in the summer of 2020, we saw many sort of long-term U.S. brands shed their racialized advertising. So I'm thinking here of things like Uncle Ben's and Aunt Jemima, right, which had come into being at the turn of the 20th century when racialized and racist advertising connected to a brand was a surefire way to make a lot of money.
Yep.
And so I guess I'm wondering, so on the one hand, you have this sense of like maybe growing corporate responsibility around racialized branding set right next to what feels like maybe less corporate responsibility relative to this body branding.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's sort of another leg to this whole trend where like years ago, you started to see the beginning of this with like the Colin Kaepernick Nike partnership. And you had that, I think it was Kendall Jenner, that Pepsi ad where, you know, she's like handing a Pepsi to a police officer during a protest, and it's supposed to symbolize like stopping the protest or whatever. So you've had like brands play in these waters the past few years. And then totally agree, during the George Floyd protest in 2020, that's when tons and tons of brands just kind of jumped in to what some people call like taking a stand or cause marketing, which is basically explicitly saying we stand for this issue now. And even if it's polarizing to them or their audience, you know, they view it as a kind of value add, whether that be for just online engagement or whether that be for maybe the owner's values, or maybe it is just like a kind of cultural Overton window shift where I think during the protests, a lot of brands felt like it was now kind of safe to move in to speaking like, oh, we're now for racial justice because it's very popular in the culture right now. So like you said earlier, I mean, these brands, it's just in their nature to kind of shift and move around as to where trends are and where they can be incentivized to make a profit. And I think that's just one of the several movements in recent years where we've seen so normalized now to see brands with political takes that it's already starting to lose some of its provocative effect that it had a few years ago.
As you talk about brands becoming people, can you talk a little bit about the 2017 Wendy's Twitter account that really got kind of up in petty corner with it and went viral as a result?
Yeah. So like when most people think about brands acting strange or human on Twitter, like their mind right away goes to Wendy's, because in 2017, they went viral for roasting a random user on Twitter who was making fun of them, calling their beef frozen. And it was so popular that Anderson Cooper actually covered it on a segment that year. And it really put this kind of landscape of brands on Twitter in the national conversation. So the trend had been going on from a few years prior to that. Since that period to now, I mean, it's really every corporation, every institution, you know, you have government agencies, even like the state of New Jersey, which now some people are familiar with, that is like a kind of funny, edgy personality on Twitter. So Wendy's was really the one that solidified the trend, but it had been going on for a few years before that.
It feels to me as though another truism in advertising is that, you know, you follow the trend for a while, but that, you know, the way that you ultimately break through is to do something counter trend, right? So if everybody else is packaging their ice cream in blue and yellow and pink, you become Breyers and you package it in black, right? At a time when black is not supposed to be something that you package food products in, and boom, you stand out. If that is right, what is the maybe on the horizon counter trend to this, where we might see brands differentiate themselves, not with lasciviousness or lecherousness, but maybe with something else in this space?
Yeah, so that's the million-dollar question. I mean, back in 2017 with this viral Wendy's moment where they're being sassy to a user on Twitter, brands quickly figured out that that was a way for them to go viral. So it became a sort of playbook, essentially, for brands to act edgy and sassy and do these clapbacks to people online. And, you know, similar to other brands that have figured out these kind of trends, once they've kind of becomes a successful case study and then everybody jumps on it until it becomes boring or lame. And then, you know, they start the next thing. But the difference, I guess, with this horny, aroused content that brands are doing now is that it's been going on for several years and it somehow has this seemingly infinite lifespan. And I think it's in part like kind of looping back around to the Trump or Elon Musk style of Twitter account, where it just has this provocation aspect to it, where even if you're sick of it personally and you hate it, so many people in that position are still willing to engage with it, you know, calling it out, so to speak. And that kind of like cycle, you know, whether you love it or you hate it, it just keeps people engaging. So I definitely think the novelty of this trend is wearing off very quickly, but I don't know if it's going to stop brands from participating in it. Because when I look at the kind of like what are left in terms of cultural taboos or uncharted territory, you know, there's very few things that even come to mind. You know, I think certain brands have already taken to criticizing capitalism as a structure, and that's kind of become, you know, like that.
Brands have taken to criticizing capitalism.
Yeah. I mean, like some explicitly, I mean, in some, you know, maybe in like roundabout ways, but it's in certain corners of the internet, I think, especially Twitter, it's a bit trendy to critique capitalism. So they kind of use that as like an anti-marketing strategy, essentially, where there's like a little, like a tinge of self-awareness to what they're doing. So you think, if they can commodify that, and then they can commodify acting aroused and like various like social justice ideas, you know, it's like it's difficult to think, you know, what is something that's going to stand out in contrast to those issues. I mean, I thought for a while maybe brands would kind of go back to direct sales tactics and just kind of being really basic, but I think when you compare that style of approach to, you know, brands talking about being aroused and mentioning genitals, like, I think it's really difficult to make that pitch as a strategy.
Oh, man, maybe Doritos will get on the couch and have some therapy on social media for all of us. Just
that's right.
Help me get out of this that I am in. Nathan Auerbach is creative director and writer covering internet culture. Nathan, come back and talk with us again about what's going on in the world of people selling us things, because I love this. Thanks so much.
Yeah, anytime. Thanks for having me, Melissa.